We are now sermon number 3 in our series, Christ's Heart for His Church. And I want you to look with me at one particular church. Last week we looked at the church of Ephesus. And today we want to look at the church that I called, and not me, Jesus called, the rich poor church. The rich poor church. And I want to, let's look at Revelation chapter 2. We're going to jump right in, verses 8 through 9. So that particular letter goes from verses 8 all the way, but I wanted to make sure that I do justice to all of the stuff that's in that letter. So we're going to end up with the part 1 and part 2. But if we were to just delve into everything, that just wouldn't do justice to the text. So the first two verses from that letter starts with Jesus's kind of like introduction to his church. To the angel of the church in Smyrna, write: these are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and who came to life again. Verse 9, I know your afflictions and your poverty, yet you are rich. I know about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. There's a story about a bunch of thieves who decided to break into a jewelry store, very high-end jewelry store. One of the people who were part of that team of thieves worked at the jewelry store, it was an inside job. In that jewelry store, they had all kinds, they had precious, you know, stones, diamonds. They had not so precious ones, like something called cubic zirconia, which is like fake diamond, and other stuff. Gold, things that look like gold but are not gold. And what they did was, they had a couple of sections assigned for the real, very expensive stuff and the not so expensive stuff. And they labeled them. So it was clearly labeled and everything done. So the plan that those thieves put into motion was not to break into the store and steal everything and make a mess of things. They worked out the camera and all that stuff, but they did something that was even more ingenious. When they got there, blocked all the cameras, did all their things, they opened the cases of all of the jewelries. And rather than stealing the jewelries, what they did was they simply went and actually switched them. You switch the cubic fake diamonds and put them in the place of the real ones, take the real ones, put them in the place of the fake ones, and then they put everything back. Nice and neat. And they left. When they came back, when the store opened up the next day, those men took money and went in and bought what the store owner thought were cubic zirconias and fake diamonds, what the store owner thought was fake gold, and they paid all that stuff. They got their receipts and they left. And then the life continued for that day. Until days after, people started coming back to the store and say, you sold me fake goods. And what those thieves did was, they simply bought the real diamonds, the real gold, because they labeled them as cubic zirconias and bad stuff, and the store ended up selling all the fake ones at really high prices. But of course, people eventually found out. But by the time they realized what had happened, those men had gone. They left. They were gone. And I think in our churches today, the same thing is happening. Except that it's not happening with diamonds or cubic zirconias or fake gold. It's happening with the very soul of the church. Satan came in a lot of the churches, switch the goods. decided that those pastors and those churches would take as important what's not important and use as those things that are not important as important. So meaning you've got churches who no longer look at the Word of God as the final authority. They don't teach the Bible. They don't spend time in prayer, but they spend their time primarily in programs to draw people in. And when they preach, they're not going to preach about church discipline, about sin, about those things that are controversial in our time, but they're going to preach things that tickle people's ears. Satan has succeeded at switching the goods. And that was the problem that Jesus had with a lot of the churches. There was some good stuff. They weren't the best stuff. There were some things that they needed to pay attention to but should have never been priorities. And they made them the things that shouldn't be priorities, priorities, and the things that should be priorities, they relegated them to things that are not important. But there was a church, thank God. In fact, there were two churches. We're going to see the second one, maybe a couple of sermons from now. But there was one church in which Satan was not able to switch the good on them. But the world thought that that church didn't matter. But to Jesus, it mattered. The world saw this church as a poor church, an uninfluential church. But Jesus saw that church as rich, as influential for him. And that church was the church of Smyrna. I'm not going to go back and explain. Those of you who are here, you realize there's a particular structure to those letters. As I said before, those letters were sent to the churches, but were handed over, were given to the pastors of those churches. And each church, as I've said last week, represented an actual church, a physical, geographical, historical church. But each church also represented all of the churches across times, across geographical locations, across continents, every single church. And the question for us, which church do we want to be? Which church are we? And last but not least, even though, as I've said before, when we look at the first church, Jesus his intention was not to simply just stomp on those churches. He knew. He commended them for things that they did that were right. But lovingly, as a gesture of grace, he reminded them of those things that they've lost. The church of Ephesus did all the right things, but they've lost their first love, their passion for Jesus Christ. But the church of Smyrna and the church of Philadelphia are actually two churches that Jesus had nothing negative at all to say. Nothing. And the church of Smyrna were in the city of Smyrna. And it was located in the city of Smyrna, which actually still exists today. And it's the name of that city now is Izmir in Turkey. And that city was a beautiful city. It was, interestingly enough, Smyrna means myrrh. And myrrh is that spice that was used back in the days to actually embalm bodies. And interestingly enough, you would see, and as you go through the letter, the relevance and the connection of that church's name to its fate, what eventually would happen to that church. As I've said before, the church is a church that was destitute. Jesus says, I know your afflictions and your poverty. And in fact, neither of those two churches, that Smyrna and Philadelphia down the road, would fit today's definition of success. Not only it was poor, but it faced all kinds of affliction. And the word that John used for poverty here is the word that talks about being completely destitute, completely broke, no resources at all. And historians tell us that possibly that church was made up of slaves, of former slaves who had nothing at all. They were financially destitute. They were under the weight of afflictions and trials and problems. They weren't your church that would be the mega church, have all the TV and radio, and the pastor would be writing books. They weren't considered a successful church. But some things about that church pleased God. And the question that came to my mind was that if they are the kind of church that pleases God, if they are the kind of church, as we're going to see, with which Jesus was fully satisfied, so why were they so destitute? Why they were not a large church by any means? They didn't have great buildings. You wouldn't be able to point to any major things that they put in place. And why wouldn't Jesus just announce to them that their deliverance was at hand? This is bad news. I know your affliction and your poverty, but there's also good news in there. Yet you are rich. And I think that's the kind of stuff that first and foremost we need to look at. What made that church so rich? You know, interestingly enough, as I said, going back to this idea of myrrh, the word Smyrna literally means myrrh. And myrrh, myrrh was used to embalm bodies, and the way, because it has a nice aroma, a nice smell, and the way you get to that smell is by crushing the myrrh. It's by crushing that spice. And then only after you crush it does it give off the fragrant aroma that makes it useful to embalm bodies and do other things. And I think the church of Smyrna was being crushed and in the process was giving up a fragrant aroma of faithfulness to God. And usually that's what happens. For God to use you and I, somehow we have to be crushed. For God to use a church, somehow you have, that church has to be crushed. I think it was A.W. Tozer who said, it is doubtful that God can use a man greatly until and unless he's hurt him deeply. And I want you to think about this for a minute. When you go through your trials, when you go through the issues of your life, whether it's an illness, whether it's persecution, whether it's people bugging you for the, not because you're annoying, but because of the sake of Jesus Christ. There's something when you go through scripture, every time God is about to use somebody, that person goes through a time of crushing, of testing, of trials. You look at Moses, spent 40 years in the desert. You look at Joseph, spent 18, 17 to 19 years in prison as a slave. You look at Jesus himself. He wanted to show the example. He spent 40 days in the desert being tempted by the devil. So the church of Smyrna, as its name implied, was crushed so that God might use it greatly. So if you want God to use you greatly, be willing for him to crush you so that he can remake you in his image. Because some of us, the way we are, God can't use us. He has to crush that thing and rebuild it. Whatever it is in your life, your self-sufficiency, your pride, your arrogance, whatever it may be, God is, I can't use this. I've got to crush it. Then only when I crush it can I just take it and remold it into what I want so that I can use him or her for my glory. And the same goes for a church. As a church, we may have to go through a time of crushing, a time in the desert before God can start using you mightily. A time in the desert can literally mean a time when you have no home. I was, you know, talking to my wife, you know, I'm like, man, you know, like, we're here today and then we got to go to another space and then come back. You know, that could be our desert. You know why? Because something God does, when God is accomplished, uses a person who's been crushed to accomplish great things. That person then no longer is able to say, I did this. Because you look back in your life, where you came from, and you've got to say to yourself, you know, there is no way that this is my work. This has got to be some supernatural work of God. It has nothing to do with me. If you're not crushed, it is likely that you'll take the credit for what God has done in your life and through you. So the pattern that Jesus follows in every one of those letters is really interesting, because what he does, he introduces himself with the title that is applicable, that is relevant, that is the answer to whatever it is that that church is facing. And Jesus, interestingly enough, he introduced himself to the church of Smyrna, who was facing severe poverty, persecutions, tribulations that in fact might and will lead to the death and imprisonment of some of the members. So Jesus introduces himself with the title, the first and the last, who was dead and came to life. He knew what they would need from him. The first and the last in the Old Testament is an old title of for Yahweh God. Jesus wanted to remind the believers in Smyrna, and he wanted to remind our church today, and he wanted to remind you that regardless of what you're going through, regardless of your afflictions, regardless of your persecutions, oppressions, or depressions that you may face, that the church may face, that Jesus is the first and the last. And what that means is that he knows the end from the beginning. And Jesus knew. He's like, he's telling them, look, all of that stuff that has happened to you, the things that will happen to you, they're not taking me by surprise. I am the first and the last. I know the end before the beginning and the beginning before the end. So whatever it is that you're going through, it is not a surprise to God. Whatever it is that our church is going through, it is not a surprise to God. The first and the last. The one who was dead and came to life. This is a reflection. This is relating. This is talking about the power that Jesus has over death. Not only he knows the end from the beginning, but he's also all powerful. So powerful that he overcame death. And if he overcame death, he was telling the church of Smyrna, you also will overcome death. And if Jesus is the first and the last, that means he's not going anywhere. That means he is with you. So I want you to understand, through one title, one introduction, Jesus was sending to that church multiple messages. And he's sending it to us as well. He's the first and the last. That means he knows the beginning from the end. He's not going anywhere. He's stable. He's with you. And here's the thing. He's with you while you're going through your trials. In the midst of it, he's there. Sometimes you will not feel him, but he's there. As I've mentioned in my first sermon in the series, you know, this little story about the man who was walking and saw four sets of footprints. And then after a while, the darkest time of his life, he only saw two sets of footprints. And he ran to God and said, wait a minute, what's up with that? When I was feeling the lowest in my life, things were the roughest, and I only see two sets of footprints. Where were you? Why would you abandon me? And Jesus says, no. Those times when you see two sets of footprints instead of four, these were the times when I was carrying you on my back. You didn't even know it. There are times you're going through some stuff as a church, as an individual. You think God is not there, but these are the times God is actually carrying you on his back and you don't even know it. He is there through your trial. And after your trials are over, he'll be there after those trials. He's consistent. He's there. So what that means, as he introduced himself, the message that he's conveying is that as God is in control, he is in control. He introduced himself also not as the Alpha and the Omega. Again, repeating what he said before, the first and the last. Alpha is the first letter of the alphabet, and Omega is the last letter of the alphabet. He says, I am there. I am in control. I know what you're going through. I'm here. I'm not going anywhere, and I'm all powerful, so powerful that I have power over death, so that the worst thing that could happen to a person, frankly, is death. The worst. I mean, all of you will agree with me. You could have a loved one who is sick. But you want them. You're still hoping that they'll be with you. And Jesus says, even over death, I have power because I overcame death. So even when the worst thing could have happened to you, I've overcome personally the worst thing that could happen to a person, and I can give you the power to overcome that worst thing, which is death itself. So, this is Jesus' message to the church of Smyrna, and this is Jesus' message to you and to me as well. He's the one who established the church. And he said, the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. He is here in the midst of everything that you may be going through and that we may be going through as a church. You know, there's one thing that human beings can't promise you, that they will always be there with you. You could have the most faithful friend, the most faithful husband, the most faithful wife. But if they tell you they will be with you in every circumstance, they're lying and they don't know what they're talking about. Or they're deluding themselves, because we all know that they can't be in every circumstance, even if they wanted to. If you're stuck with an airborne illness like cholera or tuberculosis, your husband, your wife, your friends, your children, they won't be able to be right there with you because you'll be quarantined. Even if they were crazy enough to want to be there with you, they'll be kicked out. They can't be there with you. If you find yourself on the way to jail, you're going alone. The judge decides who goes and who doesn't go. Only Jesus can say, I will be with you in every circumstance, because he's the first, because he's the last, Only Jesus can say that because he is God. And only him, he has the power over all circumstances, over all times, and over all people. He's absolute over his church, over his people. So in the midst of your affliction, know that Jesus is the first and the last. He's the Alpha, he's the Omega, he's God. In fact, in Isaiah 44, verses 6 through 9, he says something really important. He says, this is what the Lord says, Israel's King and Redeemer, the Lord Almighty, I am the first and I am the last. Apart from me, there is no God. And then continue in 7 and says that if who then is like me? Let him proclaim it. Let him declare and lay out before me what has happened since I established my ancient people in what is yet to come. Yes, let them foretell what will come if they can. Continue in verse 8. Do not tremble. Do not be afraid. Did I not proclaim this and foretell it long ago? You are my witnesses. Is there any God beside me? No, there is no other rock. I know not one. In verse 9, and it continues, all who make idols are nothing, and the things they treasure are worthless. Those who would speak up for them are blind. They are ignorant to their own shame. He said it again, same thing in Isaiah 43. Verses 12 to 13, he says, listen, I've revealed and saved and proclaimed, I and not some foreign God among you, you are my witnesses, declares the Lord that I am God. In verse 13, yes, and from ancient days I am he. And here's the thing, look at this. No one can deliver out of my hands. When I act, who can reverse it? And the reverse is true. He can deliver out of anybody's hands. And when he sets you free, no one can reverse it. When he delivers you, no one can reverse it. So when you're going through your times of affliction, and you want to be discouraged, Jesus is the first, Jesus is the last. And here's what he's saying. He's saying that he can shake the very foundations of the earth. He can spread out the heavens to bring about your deliverance and your victory. That's what Jesus was trying to tell that church. Through all of the stuff that they're going through, they needed to be poor. They needed to be afflicted so that they could experience the power of that God who is the first, the last, the beginning, the end. That church was going to face death. It was going to face death, and Jesus wanted to remind that church that because it conquered death, they also will conquer death. So in one introduction, Jesus wanted to explain and say, this is who I am right now. You may be destitute, but I have the power to overturn it. You may be poor, but I declare you rich because you have the riches that I value, that I treasure as your God. And Jesus continued for that church. You know, he said, I know your affliction. And here's the interesting thing. There are two words that he could have used to talk about when he say, I know your affliction. He could have used one word, gnosko, that talks about intellectual knowledge. Knowledge that you gain from observation. And then there's another word that he used that is actually used less often in the New Testament. It's the word oida. And that word means, it's the word of knowledge gained by experience. I've been there. When Jesus says, I know your affliction, he wasn't telling them that I observe your affliction. I see your affliction. It means I've been there. And that's what the author of the book of Hebrews mentioned when he says, we're not serving a God who cannot empathize with our troubles, our trials. He's been there. So whatever you're going through, you are betrayed by somebody, Jesus was betrayed. You're hungry, you're broke. Yes, financially at some point, even though Jesus was the God of the universe, he was broke at some point. Financially, he wanted it. But everything that you're going through, Jesus went through. Most of it, except for your sin. So he told them, I know your affliction. I know how things are. I know things are rough. I know things are tough. But I know. And when Jesus says, I know your affliction, affliction here, the word is basically referring to something that is bearing you down, that is crushing you. That's unbearable. And he knows. And what are the source of their afflictions? Number one, the first source of the affliction was they had an uncompromising stand. They weren't going to compromise, just like the church of Ephesus. And because they weren't compromising, they were paying the price. How many churches don't have that kind of uncompromising stand? They refuse to teach about things that are controversial because they want to stay under the radar. They refuse to do church discipline because they don't want people not to walk away out of that, walk out of that church and not give. They had an uncompromising stand. And because of that, they were paying the price. The second source of their affliction, obviously, also was their material poverty. They were poor. They were destitute. They had nothing. In fact, as I said, they were potentially either former slaves or current slaves or beggars. They had nothing. But Jesus said they were rich. It didn't say they were rich because they could name it and claim it. We've got some theologians out there that just say, you know, just name it and claim it. Whatever you want, name it and claim it. That is not what he was saying. They were rich because they had their priorities straight. They may not have any money, but in the eyes of God, in the eyes of Jesus Christ, they were rich. Why? Because they had a love for Jesus Christ, first of all. They loved God. And number two, they were living obedient lives. They trusted God. And their third source of affliction was they were being slandered by the Jews of the time. And they were slandered because actually of their obedience to God and misunderstanding of those Jews at the time. You see, they were being slandered. They were being called cannibals because every Sunday they would have Holy Communion. And when they have Holy Communion, and what do we say when I do it, when Pastor Jen says, the body of the Lord, let us eat. So people are hearing things and are coming to the church and say, my goodness, these people, they're eating bodies. When they go in that church, they're eating, literally eating bodies. They were also being slandered and called perverted people because the people have heard that they would greet each other with a holy kiss. So they were being slandered. They were accused of being cannibals. They were accused of immorality and orgies because of the misunderstanding of the concept of believers coming together and greeting each other with a holy kiss. You know, here's my question for you, and I want to just wrap it up. If you are accused of being a Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict you? I'm afraid if someone were to accuse you to be a Christian at work, you would go scot-free. You would be found innocent of all charges. Because there would not be enough evidence in your life at work to convict you of being a Christian. These people, they were poor. They were under pressure. But they were rich. And I want you to wrap it up in a couple of things. Jesus called them rich because he was referring to a spiritual richness. Spiritual riches in the heavenly places. What he was saying was that the believers in the church of Smyrna knew and they had what mattered. They had a close, a deep, abiding relationship with Jesus Christ. They were rich because they looked up to Jesus Christ. They loved Jesus Christ above all else. And because of that, and because of the trials and the tribulations that they were going through, coupled with their love for Christ, they became spiritually mature Christians. And it was Paul who said it well. So everything that goes in your life, every trials, every troubles, every issues that you go through, there is a purpose for it. And a lot of times people misunderstand Romans 8:28. When Paul says, for we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him. And some people just say, well, all things work together for good. All things don't always work together for good. God works all things for the good of those who love him. And then people sometimes forget verse 29. It says, God works all things for the good of those who love him, of those who've been called according to his purpose. And then he said, for those he foreknew, he also predestined to be what? Conformed to the image of Jesus Christ. So that he may be the first amongst many brothers. So what does that mean? What's that purpose? That purpose is resemblance to Jesus Christ. That purpose is for God to use whatever is going on in your life. The good, the bad, the ugly. For you to become like Jesus Christ. And this is not a sexy message. This is not a message that churches want to preach. They want to tell you if you lose your job, it's going to work out for good because God is going to give you a bigger job. That's not necessarily the case. Maybe that job kept you from being the person that God called you to be, from having that relationship with God. So Jesus is telling you, hey, my relationship with you, resembling me, you maturing in your faith is more important than some relationship, than some job. They were mature and they got it. They were rich because Jesus was the ultimate model and example. So they knew if Jesus had to endure trials, the expectation is that they would also undergo trials. And I think for us, we get disappointed with God because our expectation of what we want from God does not equal reality, that the reality that we experience, and therefore we become disappointed. But if we expected things to go wrong, if we expected things to go bad in our lives, knowing that we live in a sinful world, knowing that we live in a world that defies and despises and hates Jesus Christ, you wouldn't be surprised when things go wrong in your life. And lastly, they were rich because they were clearly a threat to Satan. Jesus says, the Jews who thought they were Jews, but they are a synagogue of Satan. These are people who are portraying themselves to be Jews, but they are basically being used by Satan himself. Why? Because that church was clearly a threat to Satan in his worldly kingdom. And my question for us as a church is, are we a threat to the kingdom of Satan? Because you know why? When a church is not a threat to Satan, Satan leaves that church alone. In fact, Satan has a vested interest in making sure that this church continues to grow numerically. Satan has an interest to make sure that all goes well with this church because they are not a threat. And God calls us to be a threat to Satan and his kingdom. And when we become a threat to Satan and his kingdom, he's going to act. He's going to act up. He's going to persecute. He's going to make things hard. But that's when you know that you are at that point rich in the eyes of Jesus Christ. So I call you today individually and as a church to be that rich, poor person. I call you individually and as a church to be a threat to Satan, to be a threat to his kingdom. And even though he will attack you, even though he will persecute us as a church, but we have Jesus who tells us he's the first, he's the last, he's the beginning, he's the end. He's there to stay, and he's got our back. May God bless you.